You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 15th of March 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is The Monocle Daily. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up, dozens die in one of New Zealand's darkest days.
These are people who I would describe as having extremist views that have absolutely no place in New Zealand and, in fact, have no place in the world.
We'll have the latest from the country after the attack on two mosques in Christchurch, now known to have killed at least 49 people. We'll learn more about the alleged attacker and ask what more can be done to combat the spread of extremism and bigotry online. Also tonight, the countries that are struggling to come to terms with their colonial pasts. Plus the latest from the South by Southwest Festival in Texas. And a female presenter is finally breaking the glass ceiling of late-night television in the US. All in the next hour on The Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. Hello, welcome to today's Monocle Daily. It was, according to New Zealand's Prime Minister, one of her country's darkest days. 49 people murdered in Christchurch. That is more killings in one day than New Zealand would normally experience in a year. 41 people died at the Al Noor Mosque and seven others at a mosque 2 miles away. Another victim died later in hospital. Three people are currently in custody. The suspected attacker, who is believed to be an Australian, is said to have posted an extremist manifesto online and to have live-streamed part of his attack on social media. In tonight's programme, we'll get the latest from New Zealand and reaction from around the world to Friday's events in Christchurch. With me in the studio this evening is Lloyd Burr, who is the Europe correspondent for New Zealand's News Hub. We will cross to New Zealand first, though, and to his colleague, Anna Bracewell-Worrell, who is on the line. And it's coming up to lunchtime now in New Zealand on the Saturday. What's the latest?
Well, the Prime Minister gave a briefing from Parliament this morning. She said the death toll has not changed. 49 people killed. That's the same number there was last night. One thing she did say was that gun laws are going to change. That is a big kind of difference here, a very immediate response from the government. Another thing that she said is we're going to look at border control in cooperation with Australia, and New Zealand police remain on high alert.
There are dozens of people still in hospital.
Yeah, that's right. Most of them in Christchurch. One child aged 3 or 4 has been flown to Auckland for treatment. Last night there were 12 operating tables with people requiring multiple surgeries that were working through the night. But as the Prime Minister said this morning, no more fatalities overnight. So that's some good news overnight. But yes, so many people injured and far too many people killed.
Once the initial shock of what's happened starts to wear off, you sort of reflect on where this leaves the country. And here we are, the national security level has never been rated at high in New Zealand before. Police telling people to stay away from mosques across the country. This is, I think a lot of people listening would think, the last place on earth that anyone would have expected this to have happened.
That's right. And the Prime Minister said yesterday, you know, that's why New Zealand was a target. It's unexpected. It's particularly shocking. I think there's an overwhelming sense of confusion. And the main question is how? How did this happen? How were these people not picked up? Or this person, we're actually not 100% sure how many people were actually behind the shootings at this stage. It appears that one may have been kind of the orchestrator, but there are some other people of interest. There's going to be a lot of soul searching, I think. How could this kind of what appears to be incredibly racist rhetoric have existed and remained under the radar?
Well, indeed, police described this yesterday as a well-planned attack. But we have been told that none of the three in custody, including the main suspect, were on any watch list in New Zealand or in Australia. And indeed, that the alleged attacker had a gun license and had bought his guns legally. All of that is bound to raise questions about whether sufficient watch is being kept on alleged white supremacists and far-right extremists.
That's right. And there have already been questions raised about whether our security agencies focus too much on Muslim extremists and not enough on, white supremacists, for example, or other kind of white extremists. So some major questions there. I think I would not be surprised if there is some focus shifted within our security agencies following this attack. Too early to say, though, with any kind of certainty.
Anna, stay with us. Let me bring in Lloyd. Lloyd Burr, who's News Hub's Europe correspondent, with me in the studio. There was a vigil earlier today here in London.
Yeah, there was. It was sort of organised last minute, but it was really, really incredible, actually. Very emotional. I was a bit teary at this vigil. It was held in Hyde Park Corner at the New Zealand Memorial there. And around 300 expats, Kiwis, turned up there and laid flowers, and we sung some songs, some waiata, we call them in New Zealand, Por Kari Kariana. We sung Whakaria Mai and the national anthem as well. And it was just a chance for people to kind of come together and, I guess, attempt to get their heads around what it is that's happened back home, because it really is hard to grapple with this when you see it on the telly. You see it on the newspapers, like the Evening Standard had massacre at the mosque. You know, you see all this stuff about New Zealand on the front pages of these papers, and you hear it on the radio. And so it's a really confusing time for a lot of Kiwis over here, worrying time and emotional time. So it was really nice for us to have that space and that event for us to come together and kind of talk to each other. Sometimes some people didn't want to talk, they just wanted to sort of stand there and be in silence to try and get your head around what it is that happened. So it was a really, really nice event.
And you obviously couldn't be much further away from home to be seeing this sort of stuff coming in onto your phone in the middle of the night, really, in UK time. And it's something we were talking about there with Anna, that this is more deaths in one day, more murders in one day than New Zealand would normally experience in a year, which gives you a sense of how out of the ordinary this is.
Yeah, New Zealand is known for having lots of sheep, or known for Lord of the Rings, or for the All Blacks. We're not known as a country that has a lot of terrorism or extremism or a lot of divisions and things like that. So this has come as a real huge shock to people. It's kind of cuts to the heart of our national identity and who we are, because we're just known as being a peaceful people and being friendly and being kind and being open-minded. And when you have an event like this happen, when you have an event like this that happens, that cuts to the heart of Islamophobia and intolerance, it really does make you question your country, where you come from, and what on earth is going on back home. And it does make it really hard being on the other side of the world.
And inevitably, we were talking earlier that the police have been advising people to stay away from mosques in New Zealand. We've seen security tightened in the UK and in France and in other countries. There are going to be fears of copycat attacks.
One of the hardest things that I saw, one of the images that kind of got me, was my hometown of Tauranga, which is in the Bay of Plenty in New Zealand, one of the mosques there, seeing that guarded by armed police with these massive big weapons. Seeing a mosque, a place of worship, being guarded by armed police is pretty heartbreaking. Now, I know over here in the UK you guys are used to police walking around with guns. It's sort of normal over here, but in New Zealand, police officers don't carry guns. That's just the rule. We don't have an armed police force unless there is an event in which you get the armed offenders squad. But our police aren't armed other than with a taser. So to see police officers guarding mosques around New Zealand is really, it hits home. It really does hit home.
Let's just return to Anna in New Zealand. You mentioned earlier that the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, talked today about the need to change the gun laws. There are around 250,000 people in New Zealand who have gun licenses. And there have been attempts in the past, haven't there, to change this?
Yeah, and in 2017, there was a review of our firearm laws. And one of the recommendations that came out of that review was that there's an investigation of the creation of a category of restricting semi-automatics and shotguns. And that recommendation was rejected. So I think there will be a lot of kind of political soul searching about why we rejected that recommendation. There are some other recommendations that came out of that review that were also rejected, including firearms, a firearms license being required to possess ammunition. So these kinds of recommendations that were rejected as part of that review will certainly come under some scrutiny in the coming days. Although I think for now, there's still the shock to deal with, confusion and still a sense of fear.
Anna, thank you very much. Anna Bracewell-Wallace from News Hub in New Zealand. Lloyd, stay with us. Now, the alleged attacker is said to be an Australian citizen, Brendan Tarrant, who described himself as an ordinary white man. This ordinary white man was, however, seemingly inspired by mass killers and past battles against Muslim armies. Well, we can speak now to Karen Middleton, who's chief political correspondent of Australia's Saturday paper and covers politics in the country from Canberra. Karen, what reaction to that news that the alleged attacker is from Australia?
Well, it's horrifying. I think it's horrified all Australians. We've seen vigils overnight Australian time in mosques around the country, including here in Canberra and in the biggest mosque in Sydney, in Lakemba. We've seen religious leaders from all faiths condemn this. We've seen political leaders from all faiths condemn this. And Australians are appalled and horrified both that one of our citizens could potentially be the person who did this and also at what the implications are for our own country here, which is very similar to New Zealand and very close by.
Well, indeed, Tarrant, we've been told, wasn't on a watch list in New Zealand, wasn't on a watch list in Australia, had a gun license in New Zealand, bought his guns there legally. That's going to cause alarm.
Yes, indeed, it certainly is. We've got very tough gun laws in this country that Australians are, I think, in the majority, very proud of for the last 20 years that arose from a terrible massacre more than 20 years ago here. But, you know, it's obviously possible for people to get hold of these things. Brendan Tarrant, as we understand, comes from the town of Grafton in northern New South Wales. It's a rural town. He's a country man, grew up there and lived there for many years. And it is a... It's a conservative part of the country, I guess. It's inland, just south of Brisbane. And in that area, there has been a sort of strong conservative streak, socially conservative. And this is the sort of sentiment in the extreme, very extreme sentiment, that this man has been expounding.
Well, he is said to have posted this manifesto online in which he rants about Muslims, vows to avenge deaths that he blames on followers of that faith. It clearly has... seemingly been spending a great deal of time online sort of researching and developing this hatred.
Well, that manifesto that is allegedly from him also brags about having planned this, having moved to New Zealand with this intent, having chosen the victims. And we're also being told that the weapon that was allegedly used is inscribed with all kinds of words, including the names of people who committed other atrocities similar to this in other countries. So this is not a random accidental attack. This is somebody, if it proves to be this man, who has thought very carefully about what he's doing.
Now, you mentioned the concerns there that he wasn't on any watch list, but presumably authorities in Australia will now want to know who he was associating with there.
Absolutely. And the Prime Minister has assured Australians that that is all underway, that all of the security agencies are obviously scouring his social media profile. The other horrifying aspect of this is that he live streamed this event onto social media. People are being urged not to share that video because that will not help. And there's obviously a risk of copycat behaviour from other people. But they are scouring that social media profile, which is quite extensive, to see not only what else he might have thought about doing, but who he's been associating with and whether there's a risk of any of those people doing something similar.
Well, meanwhile, one Australian senator has come in for criticism after appearing to blame Muslims for the attack.
Yes, Senator Fraser Anning. Now, he came into Parliament in controversial circumstances. People might remember that in Australia we've had a series of people have to leave the Parliament when they were discovered to have been dual citizens and therefore not eligible to serve under the Constitution. Now, Senator Anning's come into parliament as a result of one of those people leaving. That person was a senator for the One Nation Party, which is an extreme right party here in Australia. And he himself had been down the ticket when they went to the last election, only received 19 individual votes for him personally. But the way the system works here in the Senate, if someone retires or resigns midterm, they are replaced by the person who was next on their own party ticket. That's how he's ended up in parliament. But he is attracting a lot of all the wrong kind of attention today for those incredible extreme sentiments expressed after this event.
Karen Middleton from the Saturday Paper in Australia, thank you very much for your time today. Well, News Hub's Lloyd Burr is still with me here in the studio. Lloyd, in the hours after the attack, Jacinda Ardern said that New Zealand was targeted, she said, precisely because the country has embraced diversity and has embraced compassion and been open to other faiths and other cultures. But those are the principles that are bound to come under pressure in the response to an incident like this.
Yeah, in the manifesto of the suspect, the dude who allegedly did this thing, he talks about how he came to New Zealand just to train. He wasn't going to carry out the attack in New Zealand, but he came to New Zealand just to train how to do it. And as soon as he got to New Zealand, he realised that it was the perfect place to carry it out because New Zealand is so open and free and enjoys a whole lot of freedoms that a lot of other countries don't. Talking about getting on an aeroplane, you don't have to go through a scanner if you're going on a regional flight. Lots of different things like that. And so he kind of realised that New Zealand was the perfect place to do it because it would cause so much controversy with an attack like this happening in New Zealand. And, you know, he was right. It has caused a lot of controversy. It has raised a lot of questions, and I don't think New Zealand will ever be the same. Yes, we can talk about how we're not going to let the terrorists win and things like that, but in order to stop this happening again, there's going to have to be a whole lot of changes. So I do think it's going to affect the freedoms of New Zealanders.
We need to reflect on one other aspect of the attack that we haven't talked about yet, which is that the alleged attacker streamed the preparation for this attack and the beginnings of it live on the internet. And while those videos have been taken down since, they have been copied and spread and shared. And this is a different world to even 5 years ago.
I woke up. That's one of the first things I watched when I sort of checked my phone in a sleepy haze this morning at 3 a.m. UK time. And that was one of the first things that I saw, was before it was taken down. And I just could not believe it. I thought it was a video game. I thought it was graphics. I didn't think it was real life. And I really regret watching it. And I just can't believe that he planned this attack right down to the fact that he was going to wear a helmet camera and live stream it to social media in order to, so the world could see what he was doing. And he began that video by saying, "Let the party begin." But you're right, it's hard 5 years ago to think about someone live streaming them carrying out mass murder, a terror attack in New Zealand.
Lloyd Burr, thank you very much for coming in this evening. Now, New Zealand's Muslim population is estimated at around 46,000, which is less than 1% of the country's entire population. And as we were saying moments ago, the country's Prime Minister has praised the openness of the New Zealand culture and its support for diversity. But this is obviously going to present a challenge to that. Well, joining me now, Dr. H.A. Hellyer, who's a Senior Fellow in International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute here in the UK. We heard earlier that the alleged attacker had published this online manifesto, but the themes contained within it have a very long history, don't they, in the far right?
They do, and I think that's important to point out, but there's something else that's rather disturbing here. The themes that he talked about, that the alleged attacker, you know, we're still waiting for the trial and, you know, all of that. So I know that we have to be careful about how we describe the guy. But the themes are not limited to the far right. The themes aren't limited to extremists. The themes have been mainstreamed. All of these concerns that he expressed in the way in which he expressed them with regards to migrants, with regards to Muslim populations in the West, and casting them as aliens that are looking to destroy the West from the inside. These are things that he's not alone in saying. We've allowed this sort of rhetoric to become mainstreamed in far too much of our political discourse, in far too much of our media discourse.
You say it's been allowed to become mainstream. I mean, it's often thought of by a lot of people as being something that is hidden or is spread online. But you think that actually politicians in the mainstream haven't done enough to confront this?
Look, I don't think that I think we have to be very clear about this. The most powerful politician in the world, Donald Trump, said, "Islam, I think Islam hates us." You have politicians all across Europe who are in positions of authority, such as Viktor Orban in Hungary, or the Freedom Party in Austria, or indeed within our own Conservative Party in the United Kingdom, saying things that are incredibly, incredibly bigoted about Muslim populations and communities living amongst us. So no, it's not something that's marginal. It's not something that's on the extremes of our societies. We've allowed it to become far more entrenched. And I think we have to admit that and face up to it.
Now, you helped the British government in looking at ways to counter radicalization after the July 7th attacks, nearly 14 years ago now. But one thing that has changed since then is the ubiquity of the internet as a means of spreading this far wider.
That's true. But there are two things here. First, when the 7/7 attacks were about extremist Islamism, and there was a great deal of urgency that was presented, and you had politicians that were willing to be very, very forthright about this for a variety of reasons. I still haven't seen that same sort of forthrightness when it comes to far-right white nationalism. So I think that's one factor that's very different, and regrettably so. The second thing is that, indeed, you have the increased use of social media and the internet and people becoming really radicalized in really awful ways by simply not leaving their homes and looking at this sort of stuff online. And I think you see that a lot in the networks that result in a manifesto like the one that we saw released yesterday, but also in people like Anders Breivik when he carried out his massacre in Norway in 2011. And the discourse, look at the discourse, look at who he's talking about, look at the references that he has. The references aren't just all a whole bunch of, you know, far right wing nutcases. There are people like Melanie Phillips. There are people like Richard Spencer. This sort of rhetoric is dangerous.
How do we counter it, though?
With leadership. This is what we've been trying to say for the past decade. When politicians and people of in positions of authority, either within the media, you know, or within politics, but people who actually carry weight in society, when they're unwilling to face up to the problems that we see, and I'm afraid we are unwilling. We have all of this anti-Muslim bigotry that has been pointed out in the Conservative Party, just as an example, over the past few years. And it's a lone Baroness Saida Warsi who's been pushing forward on this, and she's alone within the Tories trying to find a way to actually push back against this properly with a proper inquiry. And she hasn't been successful. Why? Where's the leadership from within the party in order to face down this sort of issue? You have people who are far more intellectually grounded within the universities and in academia who are saying some of the most vile sort of hate speech, but they're couching it in this grand sort of eloquence. But at the end of the day, they're talking about otherizing Muslim communities and saying that they're not indigenous and intrinsic to our societies. They're aliens who are trying to destroy our civilization from within. And we don't have people who are willing to stand up and say, no, this sort of rhetoric has a cost, it has a price, and we should never be willing to pay it.
Dr. Hellier, thank you very much for your time today. New Zealand's Prime Minister has now travelled to Christchurch with political rivals to meet some of those who were affected by Friday's attacks. As we grieve, Jacinda Ardern said a few hours ago, we seek answers.
I want to start by saying that we are currently dealing with an unprecedented situation in New Zealand. It's very grave, it's very serious.
It is clear that this can now only be described as a terrorist attack.
He just came in, he was shooting ad hoc. I don't know, actually I haven't seen him because I just lay down under the bench and I'm thinking that, you know, if I get out, I'll get shot, so I'm just keeping my fingers crossed.
He would have a big gun, okay, and a lot of bullets, you know, okay, and he came through and he started shooting like everyone in the mosque, like, you know, everywhere.
I was actually very worried when I woke up to the news of, like, the shootout, and first thing that came to my mind was our cricketers are there, you know, and very thankful to Allah that they have been saved and they were just not there when the entire situation happened.
Through terror attacks that have taken place on UK soil, We know only too well the pain that such horrifying attacks can cause. As New Zealand has stood by us, so we stand shoulder to shoulder with them.
And as family members with our New Zealand cousins today, we grieve, we are shocked, we are appalled, we are outraged, and we stand here and condemn absolutely the attack that occurred today by an extremist, right-wing, violent terrorist.
These are people who I would describe as having extremist views that have absolutely no place in New Zealand and, in fact, have no place in the world. We are a proud nation of more than 200 ethnicities, 160 languages, and amongst that diversity, we share common values. And the one that we place the currency on right now and tonight is our compassion and the support for the community of those directly affected by this tragedy. And secondly, the strongest possible condemnation of the ideology of the people who did this. You may have chosen us, but we utterly reject and condemn you.
Well, a little later in the programme, we'll take a look at some other stories, including what's dominating discussion at this year's South by Southwest in Texas. We'll also take a look at the representation of women in the late-night TV scene in the United States. First of all, though, we'll catch up with some of the day's other top news stories. Donald Trump has vetoed a move by Congress to revoke his declaration of a national emergency at the border with Mexico. It means Congress now needs an unlikely two-thirds majority to stop his attempt to unlock emergency funds to construct his border wall. It's the first veto of the Trump presidency. Thousands of people have joined protests in Algeria demanding the immediate resignation of the president. Abdelaziz Bouteflika has already dropped his bid for a fifth term, but demonstrators say he must stand down now. Police fired tear gas at protesters near the president's office. And thousands of school pupils around the world have abandoned their classrooms for a day of protest against climate change. The day of action is expected to extend across around 100 countries. They were inspired by the Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg, who protests every week outside the country's parliament, demanding tougher action on global warming. This is the Monocle Daily. Now, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk looks at how countries come to terms with difficult aspects of their own history by exploring the concept of empire. How do we think about it, talk about it, or teach it? What does a former coloniser owe to the formerly colonised? Well, in the programme, Andrew Muller is joined by Kim Wagner, who's a lecturer in British Imperial History at Queen Mary University of London, and by the columnist and author Nikesh Shukla. He starts by asking Kim if it's possible to diagnose what in particular about its imperial past that Britain still needs to atone for.
As far as I'm concerned, nothing. I don't think atonement is the right term here, because it has this strange connotations of religious penitence. And I think that's a deeply problematic concept, because once you've shown penitence, then you're forgiven your sins and you've washed your hands and you're free and we can forget about it. And that's not really what history is about, as far as I'm concerned.
Nikesh, this is one of the curiosities, I guess, of the idea of historical penitence or even historical apology, and we will come on to that, is how the nation or people apologised to are supposed to respond. Do you think gestures like that have any particular meaning?
I don't feel like I'm particularly interested in people apologising for the sins of the past. I'm much more interested in people acknowledging how they continue to pervade our society today and what structural, systemic and institutional problems they keep in place and uphold, and how we can undo them. Because I think the myth of Britain today is that it's a meritocracy, and if you work hard enough, then you have all of the opportunities afforded to you. And I just don't think that's true. You just have to look at the incompetence in our government to know that a meritocracy does not exist. People worked much harder than people whose daddies could position them in positions of power. And so I'm much more interested in how we acknowledge that colonialism, the empire, all of these things pervade our society today and how we can dismantle them rather than I'm really, really sorry for things that happened hundreds of years ago.
Nikesh, just to follow that up, you do there raise the interesting and I think overlooked point that there's a lot of discussion about the legacy of empire and how it affects the formerly colonized. There's rather less discussion of how it affects the former colonizer. If you think about that legacy in terms of Britain, what concrete effects of it do you see, apart from, as you just suggested there, the over-promotion of people who happen to be well-born, well-connected?
I think when we look at history, we forget things that are happening to everyday people on the ground. And I think housing is one of those things that often gets overlooked. And you just have to look at the effects of Grenfell Tower and like how that was like the culmination of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of terrible social housing policy. And just to tell you a story of like how I think this stuff manifests today, my uncle in 1968 tried to buy a house in Huddersfield, and he was told by the people who was trying to buy a house from that they had a company policy not to sell to coloured people, and the Race Relations Act had just come in 1968, which came in to basically ensure that people of colour weren't facing everyday instances of racial discrimination. And my uncle decided to take those people to court, and it was the first case ever brought under British law of racial discrimination under the Race Relations Act. And my uncle was the one who did it, and he did it at a huge great personal cost to himself. And the judgment ended up being reserved because of a technicality, and the judge in his dismissal of the case said that had he tried the case, he would have found in favour of my uncle and that discrimination had taken place. And I know I'm focusing on race here, but I think it's important to talk about what's happening on the ground, because I think it's very easy for us to think about these in sort of very, very broad academic terms, but I'm much more interested in how this affects people on a day-to-day basis. And so in 2017, you have a landlord refusing to rent out properties to South Asians because he feels that they just stink their properties out with curry, which is ridiculous because curry smells delicious. But the sad thing, I remember when I talked to my uncle about this case in 2017, he said, it feels like the UK has done so much to ensure that legally we all have the same rights, but it's done nothing to change the hearts and minds of people. And that is the real tragedy of this country. And that has stayed with me for the last 2 years, and it haunts me. And I do think that that is an after effect of the British Empire.
Kim, I want to discuss a specific example here, which I know you've written about. That's the Amritsar massacre in 1919. David Cameron visited the site in 2013 when he was Prime Minister and described the event as deeply shameful, but he stopped short of issuing a full apology on behalf of the UK. An acknowledgement like that, if it doesn't actually do any good, can it be said to really do any harm?
It does, in the sense that David Cameron was very explicitly quoting Churchill in the denunciation of the massacre. And that's where you see the problem come in, that you can have someone like Churchill openly on the floor of the House of Commons in 1920 denouncing General Dyer's actions as being un-British. This is not the way we run the empire. If we look at Churchill's record, it's not as if Churchill was in any meaningful sense critical of the use of violence within the empire. So again, you can apologize for the Amritsar massacre as a way to save the legitimacy and the pride we take in empire. So it doesn't actually end up becoming an acknowledgement of the violence, but rather marginalizing that and say, oh, here we have a bad apple, a rogue officer, and a singular moment of excess, whereas by and large the empire was run as a great efficiency and cultural sensitivity, which is, objectively speaking, incorrect.
Kim Magner, a lecturer in British Imperial History at Queen Mary University of London, talking to Andrew Muller. That is part of the new edition of The Foreign Desk. You can hear it in full on Saturday at midday London time, any time after that, at monocle.com. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, the South by Southwest event packs an awful lot into 10 days. There are films, music, politics, business, and plenty of social issues too. It basically takes over Austin in Texas with around 75,000 people attending, among them Martin Swant, who's from Adweek and is on the line now. Martin, lots of different issues have come up this year. Let's explore a couple of them, starting with, and this is an odd way to start, it is apparently a big year for cannabis.
Indeed it is. And that's kind of a surprise for here down here in Texas, where it is technically still illegal. So this year, South by Southwest actually added on a cannabis track towards the tail end of the conference, where there were about 60 different talks ranging from the uses to regulation and everything in between. Last year, just to put that into comparison, they had 6 talks last year. And so it's 10 times as many, which I guess is a sign of the times.
So this is obviously that sense that as states start to alter the laws on this, as it starts to become more of a business, then obviously people who want to seek a way of making a profit from it see an opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. So here, you know, on the ground, you have a lot of brands, whether it's cannabis brands or CBD brands, just educating, attendees and even just more broadly users here at the music part of the festival on these products. There's a magazine called The Fader, which is partnering with a CBD brand out of Portland. They actually have a CBD vending machine, so people can get a free vape pen or whatever else. And since it's still a new market, so people are just trying to figure out what's actually out there and what might people want to use. But it's tricky because of regulations. They actually, a lot of these companies can't even say specifically what they're used for. So they can't necessarily say it's going to be used to treat anxiety, but they can say it can be used to calm your mood. And so a lot of these people are trying to figure out, how do you articulate something that's not really even that well known yet?
Other conversations going on around data privacy and this sort of backlash against technology companies.
Yeah, so that's been definitely one of the key themes here this week. There've been a number of high-profile speakers that have been talking about that. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who just a day or two before the conference released a kind of a broad plan for potentially regulating and maybe even breaking up some of the big tech companies. She was one of the speakers. One of the panels I went to was Roger McNamee, who was an early investor of Facebook, who has become a pretty vocal critic of the company. And he talked a lot about even Facebook's newest plans to try to fix some of the privacy issues. But and so it's just been interesting to see a lot of these people figure out, what would it even look like to regulate technology? Since it's something that a lot of people don't even understand, you know, the regulators don't understand the ad tech space or even how these companies collect data. And bringing these issues to a mainstream conference right before, you know, the 2020 election could be a pretty key moment, I think, for bringing a lot of these nitty-gritty issues into the broader spotlight.
And what there's also been, obviously, is a huge loss of trust among consumers.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the interesting thing, too, is because everyone uses Facebook. More than 1 billion or 2 billion people use Facebook. But I think a lot of people, just, you know, your average person doesn't necessarily always understand how that data is being used. Every time you press a like button or every time you go to a website, that's potentially information that advertisers could use to target you with ads down the road. And so I think there's been a lot of education that's happened over the past couple of, you know, year or so. You know, this weekend actually marks a year since the Cambridge Analytica scandal from last March. And so there's been a lot of learning, I think, both on the regulatory side, but also even just on the user side of, you know, what do these companies really know about you?
Now, a lot of discussion also I hear of blockchain. I'm going to be absolutely honest. I've tried to understand what blockchain is, and I've never been successful.
You know, you're not the only one, to be honest. That's something I've started covering more recently, about 6 months ago or so. That's another one of the new tracks here. It's a 2 or 3 day track with a lot of talks ranging from what does it mean for the cryptocurrency space to how could this technology affect the way that you buy, say, like tickets potentially down the road, you know, for concerts, to what does it mean for media companies? So I think this week, so blockchain, you know, it's even the definition is something that people debate. And that's something that's been, honestly, I haven't heard too much talk on the definition, but it's just a way of decentralizing a lot of the internet as it is right now, and also building a new framework for, like, how do you build trust into the way that computers talk to each other and that the way the data flows. And that's, of course, a oversimplified way of talking about it. But this is the first year they've had a track devoted towards that.
And why were some of the big music streaming companies less prevalent this year?
You know, that's a good question. In previous years, Spotify, Pandora, they've all sponsored major stages. And so I asked the companies why they're having a smaller presence. And one company, Pandora, said that they're just focusing more on smaller, intimate experiences throughout the year rather than making a big splash here at South By. That also kind of relates to they're doing, I think, some music videos potentially with some of these artists, and I don't really know what their full plan is, but they're scaling back. So I don't know what it says about the relevancy of South by Southwest or what it means about the focus of these companies. But I mean, of course, there's still plenty of music down in Austin, a lot of showcases with smaller bands, but it seems to have been a smaller role than previous years.
Now, lastly, why so many scooters?
You know, I will admit they are pretty fun, and thankfully I've not crashed yet. But there are about four or five different scooter companies here, and I don't know how many thousands of scooters are across the city, but I think this is a big moment because the conference is massive, covers all of downtown Austin, and you know, a 15 to 20 minute walk all of a sudden becomes a 5 minute scooter ride that costs $1 versus, you know, hopping in a car and paying $10 and sitting in traffic. So it's been an easy way to get around, but it's also been kind of a dangerous thing. I saw one report that there, you know, obviously there have been some injuries. A lot of people don't really know how to go with the traffic flow. So it's, I think it's a kind of a breakout moment for scooters. Obviously there are a lot of cities, just like we had with ride sharing. You can't necessarily just jump into a city and start using Uber, but these scooter companies are trying to, I think, hit the masses first in a more, for lack of a better word, nuanced way, I think, than some of the car companies that just kind of barged into different cities.
Now, let me just check. Are we talking about scooters in the sort of 1960s mods and rockers version of a sort of small motorbike, or are we talking about a skateboard with a handlebar on it?
Yeah, that's a good distinction. So it's definitely more of a skateboard with a handlebar. You hop on.
That's a child's form of transport, isn't it? That's what children are. My daughter's got one of those.
You know, that's a good point. Yeah, but these are electric and they go 25 miles an hour. So I don't know if it'd be safe for a child.
They don't sound safe for anybody, to be honest.
No, that's a good point. I will say they are kind of fun.
Martin, I urge you to wear a helmet. Safety always.
I will try.
Martin Song, exactly. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us for the latest there from South by Southwest. Stay with us in just a moment on The Daily. We'll take a look at the top stories across Asia.
How do we make better cities? Places that work for people of all ages and backgrounds and provide the obvious essentials from great transport to perfect places to work, as well as the softer elements that truly deliver quality of life from urban swimming pools to rooftop clubs. Published by Gestalten, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities unpacks what makes a great city, whether you're looking for a new place to call home or need a little help fixing up your own. The latest in our series of beautiful large format books is available now. Buy yours at monocle.com/shop. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
New to Monocle 24, listen to Made in France in association with Chanel. Join Monocle's editors and correspondents on a journey through France, exploring a rich tradition of making, craft and style. Hear stories from inspirational ateliers and innovative entrepreneurs at work throughout the country.
I think that Made in France is like a synonym of quality.
Head inside the institutions that define French making. From the Ecole Boulle to Champagne Vineyards to exciting new brands in fashion and retail.
When people say, "Oh, what is French style for you in menswear?" To me, it's like Western at the feet, 501 pants, a Saint-James sweater, and a Barbour jacket. You know, it's not French items, but put together and worn it to death, and you have a French style.
Rich audio and compelling storytelling brings everything from Parisian workshops to regional manufacturers to life. Download a new episode every Sunday throughout March at monocle.com, via our app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Made in France, in association with Chanel, on Monocle 24. Listen now.
Well, next we're going to take a look at some of the stories making headlines across Asia. My guest in the studio is Simona Vittorini, who's a senior teaching fellow in the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS, where she specialises in South Asian politics. And we're going to start in India with a collapse of a footbridge in which there have been a number of deaths.
Yeah, this is the latest tragedy in Mumbai, in fact, near a train station. The latest two more have happened in the last 2 years. Points this time, six people dead, 33 injured. Luckily, this time the tragedy happened after the rush hour, so, and there's a traffic lights that were red, so it could have been much, much worse. But it certainly points to the crumbling infrastructures.
And as you say, that there've been a series of these, and there are obviously concerns about safety. And I mean, in a lot of places, this would then lead to inspections of similar bridges.
Yeah, well, the inspections have been there. They have were because precisely of the 2017 and 2018 tragedies or previous footbridge collapses, the municipality, Mumbai municipality, had carried out a number of audits. And this particular bridge had been audited and deemed safe, which obviously wasn't.
There's presumably going to be political pressure on those who are responsible for these issues.
Yes, obviously political accusations started to fly immediately after the tragedy. The parties in power and the opposition started to accuse each other. At the moment, there is a bit of tension between the state governor and the local municipality. But they all have agreed that there is a new investigation is going to be done, a new audit, and actually that the auditor, there's very recent news of just a few hours ago that the auditors made a are culpable. They didn't carry the audits as they should have done, because obviously it was a problem there.
Now, why is China repeatedly blocking efforts to designate someone as a terrorist?
There might be different reasons for that. One could be simply, you know, simple real politics.
We should say who this person is, of course.
Of course, yeah. Masood Azhar is the leader of Jaish Muhammad, who the organization has been behind the latest terrorist attack in Kashmir, where 40 army personnel, India's army personnel, were killed. India has been pushed for years to have Masood Azhar to be identified as a global terrorist through a United Nations Security Council. What is it called? The committee.
It goes through the UN. They get declared as a UN global terrorist.
Yes, and it has to be a unanimous decision. So China's veto is enough to block this proposal. China's has very strong links, economic interests in Pakistan. Often China has been a very old friend with Pakistan for seven decades. They call each other Iron Brothers. So there is always China has stepped up and to protect not just its own economic interests, but also its old relationship with Pakistan. Also, some people are arguing that India is rising, continuing rising. Economically, it's not as strong as China. Military is not as strong as China, but it's an irritant to China, especially in the Indo-Pacific Pacific region. So in a way, China is trying to contain, to distract India, rather than chasing or getting this opportunity to step on the right side, let's say.
Now, obviously, a lot of conversation in India now turning to coming elections. Mm-hmm. One slightly surprising alliance of parties.
Yes, this is the Uttar Pradesh. We're talking about Uttar Pradesh, which is one of the largest state in North India, and it is the Ohio of India, in a sense, the one that is very important for the upcoming elections. It's the one that sends the largest number of MPs to Delhi. And, the election dates were just announced last week, so parties are getting ready to run these elections, and alliances are being forged. And two of the major opposition parties to the governing BJP have recently agreed to be in coalition. Yet, and this is threatening to the BJP prospects in that particular state. So the BJP is trying to weaken this alliance, and some members of these parties are jumping ship and they're moving to the BJP.
At the same time, I say there's lots of coverage of issues that will come up in the election campaign. One is the issues around national security.
Yes. Well, this is an interesting point, because national security came up very much just after that terrorist attack that we mentioned before, the Pulwama terrorist attack. And in fact, most political parties tried to make to gain political scores out of it. And Modi's own popularity increased sharply after the attack, and especially after India's reaction to the attack, through the Air Force attack that he did after the terrorist attack. So there's been voices and people asking, let's not politicize this issue. However, other people have said, actually, we should bring it into the electoral debates precisely because to point to the to India's weaknesses in or India's failings in the security, because the latest terrorist attack, the previous terrorist attacks against army personnel shouldn't have happened. So there's something that needs to be addressed.
There's presumably... as you say, there is, on the one hand, in the wake of terrorist attacks, there's always this pressure to sort of speak with one voice and to unite and not make it a political issue. But it is very hard to resist the temptation to blame your opponent for lapses that have made it more likely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, precisely. So on the one hand, but to be honest, in the immediate aftermath of the terrorist attack, the opposition and everybody tried to speak with the same voice. And this is, anyway, the opposition did not attack Narendra Modi or did not attack the government with regards to these security lapses. And that's why the BJP and Narendra Modi have made more gains out of it.
Well, I'm sure we'll have a lot more time to talk about the Indian elections in the coming weeks. We'll have to leave it there for now, though. Simona Vittorini, thank you very much for coming in this evening. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. And finally this evening, there are few reasons to celebrate Donald Trump's arrival in the White House. They have been documented many times on this programme. Though if you're trying to sell newspapers, it's been relatively good. And if you've been trying to build audiences for cable television news as well. Or indeed, if you happen to be the presenter of a late night talk show. Because it's actually quite hard to remember what people like Jimmy Fallon, Seth Meyers or Stephen Colbert used to talk about before Donald Trump showed up. It is very much a boys' club. Or at least it used to be, as we will now learn from the TV and film critic Karen Krasanovich, who is shivering beside me in the icebox that we are calling our studio. Because, Karen, we are finally going to get a female late-night talk show host.
We are indeed. Well, actually, there were a lot of female talk show hosts, but the late-night slot is quite uniquely male, pretty much, except for Joan Rivers, who hosted The Late Show for 2 years in 1986. That's a long time ago. But yes, we have got Lily Singh, who has 14 million followers on YouTube, 8.3 million on Instagram, and 5.7 on Twitter.
That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people.
It's a lot more than me.
That's not right.
Why she got the call.
You've got to fix that.
But the critical part of that is she's a YouTuber. This is not as someone with a massive pedigree in stand-up. This is not someone who's got a big history in television. This is a YouTuber who has been hired by a network to host a major show.
It's a segment of the market that television really needs. They're really trying to eat into, cannibalize the market that YouTube and other streaming services have. And so by giving Lily Singh her own show, which is going to be on at 1:30, I think at 1:35 a.m.,
right.
It's a little late with Lily Singh, meaning, should have happened before. It's a half an hour show, and she already has quite a few people like Dwayne Johnson and other people are backing her up. So she will have celebrity guests. Now, who is going to be watching at that point in time?
This is something I've never understood about American television from my brief periods being over there. So the big shows, the Jimmy Fallons, the Stephen Colberts, all this, they're at 11:30, when most sensible people are thinking about going to bed. Then your late nights, your Seth Meyers, these kind of things, they're at 30:30.
Yeah.
Presumably, if you're still watching television, you don't have a job.
And then at 1:30, why is anyone making a television program at 1:30 in the morning?
If it's filmed in New York, then it will be watched across the nation different times. People come home from parties. People are working shifts. People have insomnia. Maybe they've taken some coffee or other things that keep them awake. Possibly record it. It's possible. It's available online as well, I'm fairly sure, because Saturday Night Live, which starts at 10:30 in New York time, is available online. So I think what they're trying to do is just steal the thunder away from streaming and do this as an experiment. And I think the fact that she came out as bisexual last month, this is a real coup, because she's not only Indian-Canadian, but she's also openly bisexual. And I think it's amazing, but she's actually quite good. She does a lot of impersonations. She pretends to be her own parents. And she looks great. She's very, very, very photogenic.
You mentioned they're online, and certainly one of the things that has really made the current generation of these late night hosts is not so much the audience that sits and watches these programs at 11:30 or 12:30 at night, or records them and watches them the next day. It's the fact that segments of these shows then get put online, go onto YouTube, get spread online, and pick up millions and millions and millions of views. I mean, I went through a long phase of coming home from the end of this program and just catching up on every single late night show, just because I needed it was kind of like an addict with a hit. I needed somebody to say something rude about Donald Trump before I could go to bed and sleep soundly.
I could call you up and do that.
We'll make a deal with you. If my internet ever fails, I will let you know.
Thank you. I think you're right. You come home, you really want to either. I mean, she's got a great energy. She could really lift you up at the end of a long day. And I think that she's very, very friendly, and she's very chipper. So I think that's good. A good thing to start your day or end your day with.
Let's just explore this. So this, in the same way that the online has been the making of some of these shows, the sharing online,
yeah,
can't deny the fact that Donald Trump has been the other massive sales boost for these programs. Because if you remove the elements of these late night shows in which they say rude things about Donald Trump, there's not a massive amount left.
It's quite difficult for comedy writers to actually make things up that are weirder than what Trump is actually saying. So there is that stumbling block. But I agree, he is great fodder. But trying to predict what he's going to say and make it more absurd is almost impossible.
And the difficulty, I suppose, is that he's not going to be there forever. I mean, we should remind ourselves of that every so often. He's not going to be there forever, unless, obviously, he declares himself king or something.
That, yes.
Then he's not going to be there forever. And they are going to have to maintain this audience growth, this success, without this sort of pinata that they can smack every night.
I think that we will get Trump fatigue. I know I've got it. And I think it's just like Brexit fatigue. We don't really want to talk about it anymore. So I think that there is that. But don't forget that the online viewing, the online content, also becomes the next day's water cooler talk. It also goes viral. It's also something you send to people. It's also something you share. And I think that there is that. So in a way, it may start at 1:30 in the morning, but it has life for the 24-hour cycle, maybe the week.
It's greatly admirable, though, that a TV network is still investing in content at 1:30 in the morning. If you happen to switch on British television at 1:30 in the morning, the only thing you're going to see is somebody either trying to encourage you to bet money on the spinning of a fictional roulette wheel or buy a steam mop.
That is true. That is true. Maybe there's something going on in America of which I'm unaware, but I think maybe people coming home, 1:30, come home from a club, maybe you leave about 12:30, something.
Those days are so far behind me that I can't even remember what that used to be.
But you're
like.
Still wearing your disco shoes, and I'm very glad to see
them. Well, it's Friday evening. It's only 11 p.m. in London. Who knows what might happen? We'll have to leave it there. Karen Krasanovich, thank you very much. That's it for this Monocle Daily. It's produced by Marcus Hippie and Ben Ryland. Our researcher was Nick Manise, and our studio manager was Sarah Miles. It's the weekend edition tomorrow from 8 a.m. London time, and the Daily will be back at 2200 in London on Monday. For now, though, from me, Paul Osborne, thank you for listening, and have a good weekend.